The March of Time. Last week, Adolf Hitler made every map of Europe obsolete.
On Friday night, I was not even thinking of Austria. Then suddenly, I knew that the deed and the hour was predetermined in history. I did not make the decision. It came to me. I did not consult anyone. I gave the orders.
In this week's big issue of Life, the news magazine of pictures, you will see the background of the man who today is the greatest single menace to the peace of the world, Adolf Hitler. You will see Hitler's younger days in the proud old Austria he is just annexed for Germany. In Life's own exclusive photographs, you will watch his triumphant ride into the land of his birth and see the vast sweep of his new empire from Königsberg to Vienna. Life shows you the new gaiety of Nazi Berlin's nightlife and the faces of young Americans who have come back wounded from the bitter war in Spain. And Life will show you genuine, unretouched photographs of the first real naval battle since Jutland. In more than 28 of its 76 jam-packed pages, this week's issue of Life, the news magazine of pictures, will bring Europe's great crisis alive for you to watch with your own eyes. And meanwhile, as stirring and important things go on happening at home and abroad, the best pictures from the storm centers of Europe and the news fronts of our troubled world continue to pour in, thousand upon thousand, to Life's editors for issues of Life to come. Be sure to get your copy of this week's Life tomorrow, Friday morning, early.
And so tonight, the editors of Life, the news magazine of pictures, present by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time.
I think the dullest place in the world is Hollywood, California. Few people can talk or know anything to talk about. But Miss Greta Garbo, I have found to be one of the most intelligent of women. I hope to see more of Miss Garbo during my vacation, perhaps in Italy.
Fortnight later, in a villa near Ravello, Italy, Philadelphia orchestra conductor and Hollywood maestro Leopold Stokowski and actress Greta Garbo are vacationing together. As correspondents fly to Ravello to follow the number one romance of 1938, only news they glean comes from talkative servants and villagers.
Maybe he is a Poland, maybe she is a Swede, but they act just like an American. Through the window I see them, doing a dance. Maybe practicing that American Big Apple.
I hid behind the hedges one morning to watch. She was milking a cow, and he was picking flowers for her and saying, "To my lady of the camellias."
Everything in the kitchen is different. Before I cook spaghetti, meat, potatoes, like that. Now, Signor Stokowski, it's just what the lady orders. Carrots, lettuce, beets, spinach. That's a love.
Today, it was learned from friends of Leopold Stokowski in Philadelphia that the famous symphony conductor will marry Greta Garbo sometime around March 17th.
Armed with substantiated reports, news hawks descend on Ravello to quiz conductor Leopold Stokowski.
That is all I can tell you, gentlemen. Miss Garbo and I are not married. You have heard incorrectly if you thought we were.
Dr. Stokowski, when will Miss Garbo see us?
Miss Garbo is waiting inside there.
Thank you, Mr. Stokowski.
Coming with us, sir?
No, no. She must tell you. Excuse me.
How do you do? How do you do, Miss Garbo?
How do you do?
Well, what do you want?
When is the wedding going to take place, Miss Garbo?
Wedding? I have never traveled much. My friend Stokowski has offered to show me some of the beautiful things in the world.
But, Miss Garbo, we heard from Philadelphia that you were going to be married.
There are some people who want to get married. There are others who don't want to get married. I have never had any impulse to go before the altar.
We understood the date had been set and everything was arranged.
I am typically alone. I live in a corner.
Did you change your mind, Miss Garbo?
I think that is all. I want to be left alone now. The interview is ended.
Sweden, 2 days later. An elderly woman talks with a news hawk.
Mrs. Gustafson, you must be proud to have a daughter as famous as Miss Garbo is.
Yeah, my great is a good girl, fine. But that's not what you came for. It's about the wedding. You want to see me?
Well, yes, I would.
I tell you the story. My daughter, she don't marry that man Stokowski, that's right. 23-year-old he is and married twice already. How could she be happy? I call her up on the telephone down to Italy and I say, what is this I'm reading in the paper? Great, I don't like it. She cries.
Mr. Stokowski is...
I tell you about that wedding. I stayed on the telephone until I hear my daughter say, all right, Mama, I will not marry him. I promise.
At week's end, Greta Garbo and Leopold Stokowski suddenly pack up, motor into southern Italy, leaving behind no forwarding address, no telephone number for parent Alma Gustafsson. 1938. Marches on. The U.S. political front. This week declaims pundit Hugh Samuel Johnson.
The bill to reorganize the executive departments is an abdication by Congress to the president. This is as dangerous an assault on our traditional political system as we have ever yet seen.
But declares an administration spokesman,
it is essential that the president's bill be passed. Far from being a dictatorial measure, it seeks to end forever the evil spoils system of political patronage, the shame of our democracy.
Thus, this week in Washington, burgeons a major new political issue. The president's plan to reorganize the federal government. Put government jobs under civil service. Undertake to consolidate or abolish present government agencies in any way he sees fit. On the floor of the Senate.
Gentlemen, the president has handed us down another decree. This time, he doesn't just want to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He wants to be the whole cheese.
Is the senator talking about the federal reorganization bill?
Yes, it is called the reorganization bill. Senators should read this bill. Gives the president the power to abolish any federal agency he takes a mind to, even the Department of Justice. Makes the president a dictator, plain and simple.
Mr. President, that's not true. All executive actions under this bill are subject to the approval of Congress.
Subject to the approval of Congress. White House pressure will see to it that senators approve. Why did the president want to make all the changes? Why not let Congress make them if they're needed?
Congress has had 43 years to do it with no result.
At least Congress has not instituted one-man government in this country.
I'll bet my head against a hole in a donut. That will never happen under Franklin D. Roosevelt.
The gentleman values his head altogether too little. Yes, gentlemen, yes. But remember, we are fighting for our democratic traditions. What we are arguing is not whether the president's objectives are proper, but whether it is proper to delegate so much power to one individual. And there are some men here who believe so strongly that it is not proper that they will never allow this bill to come to a vote in its present form.
At week's end, the legislative fight on the president's federal reorganization bill is as tough and close as the Supreme Court reorganization conflict of last summer. And hanging in the balance is the gigantic experiment to change the federal government, coordinating some 100-odd agencies into a few new departments, and setting up the first new cabinet post since 1913, Secretary of Welfare, whose department will administer the two great New Deal innovations, relief and Social Security. We'll spend nearly one-third of the government's $7 billion a year. Time marches on. In London's Westminster Abbey, each Monday until further notice, a special prayer by England's primate, the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, Guide, we beseech thee, the nations of the earth. Heal the differences that divide the nations one from another. And in thy infinite mercy, O Lord, restore the family of nations to peace, to justice, and thy grace.
This week in Barcelona, Spain.
We were on our way home from shopping. My little boy, Juan, stopped to look in the window of the confectioners at the Plaza del Torre. I called him, but he just stood there looking in. I started back, scolding him. Then there was a sharp whistle and a great explosion at the end of the block. My Juanito just disappeared before my eyes. He was not there anywhere.
Such this week is the story of one Spanish woman and one Spanish child in loyalist Barcelona. The story told 1,000 times in the past year. In Madrid, in Shanghai, in hundreds of Chinese and Spanish towns. But the first bomb that falls in this week's air raid over Barcelona is more than an instrument of destruction. And Senora Valdez and her son Juano are no mere air raid victims, but human guinea pigs in a war experiment to test a theory held by military tacticians the world over for a decade, but never before conclusively proved. A theory outlined by Italy's late great aviation general Giulio Doe.
The victor of the next world war will not be that nation whose armies are victorious in battle, but that nation which strikes first at the enemy's civilian population. Military objectives are unimportant. The important thing is to terrify and unnerve the enemy's civilian population, for which purpose aerial bombs are ideally suited.
Debris of one building was a 15-year-old boy. His body was unhurt, but something else must have been, because his face kept twitching and he could not control any of his muscles.
One struck about 50 yards from a bus. The driver was blown from his seat by the concussion. His dismembered hands still gripped the wheel. Passengers just sat there staring for 10 minutes.
They pick up the injured first and load them into ambulances. Then they tag the whole corpses and dump the dismembered parts into trucks. In one place, they were working for an hour. Finally called out the fire department and just hosed up the street.
Thus, through 38 hours of the most intensive bombing ever attempted, Barcelona's U.S. correspondents report what happens when 60 tons of TNT are dropped at random in a large city, in an extensive effort to cripple civilian morale. Summing up at day's end, reports New York Times correspondent Herbert Matthews.
It's not pleasant to see thousands of people weep. It's not pleasant to see 200 men, women, and children wiped out in a quarter of a second and think, next time it'll be me. If the purpose of this bombing is to crush the morale of Barcelona, it is entirely successful. The famous Douay theory of winning wars by slaughtering citizens has had its first successful demonstration.
In the midst of bomb-wrecked Barcelona, at his desk is exiled Austrian General Julius Deutsch, one-time leader of the Austrian Socialists, exiled from Vienna in 1934. Today, one of the top military advisors to the Loyalist War Ministry. The Austrian-born general works feverishly as dispatches in a steady stream pour into his desk.
New reports of the bombing, General Deutsch. The death list is up over 1,000 now.
Over 1,000?
Morale of the people?
Failing, sir. I'm afraid.
Yes, yes. New dispatches from the front?
Nothing new, sir. The 36th Division is still on the retreat. Alcanis has been abandoned without a struggle.
This isn't a retreat. It's a panic. Where are the reinforcements we send up? The International Brigade, our artillery.
The 39th Artillery left Barcelona this morning, sir. The International Brigade is still on its way up to the front.
If our lines aren't reassembled at once, Franco will drive right through to the sea.
We will stop it, sir.
General Deutsch.
Yes, what is it? News from the front?
No, sir. From Austria.
Oh, Austria. Well, I can't think about Austria now. Spain is the important thing.
Jose. Excuse me, sir. I think you ought to see this.
Well, put it on my desk. I'll look at it later.
It is personal, General.
Personal? What does it say?
Your wife.
Yes?
She has been arrested by the Nazis in Vienna, sir. They don't know whether she has been put in prison or...
I see. Keep me informed if anything new comes in.
Here's another message, sir.
Another? Yes?
When your mother heard that Austria had been taken by the Nazis, she committed suicide, sir.
So. Jose! Get the map of the Argonne front. Plot in the new battle line. There's an emergency meeting of the Defense Ministry at 7. Remind me to be there. Bring me the latest dispatches. Hurry, man. Don't just stand there. Hurry.
This week, two names link news of Spain and news of Austria. One is former Austrian Army officer Julius Deutsch. Today, Spanish loyalist commander, whose wife is jailed by Nazis, and whose mother is one of Austria's 140 suicides. The other is Adolf Hitler, whose 30,000 fresh German troops are being rushed to the aid of Spanish rebel General Franco. Whose 150,000-man army of invasion this week begins the military Nazification of Austria. Adolf Hitler, the new and absolute ruler of Germany and Austria.
My people, within 3 days, my home country, Austria, rushed to meet me without a shot being fired and without a single victim. German people, give me another 4 years so that I can now exploit the accomplished union of Germany and Austria for the benefit of all. What is from now on more than ever holy for us? One nation, one Reich, Germany. Sieg Heil!
As Adolf Hitler finishes, into song with one voice break the masked Nazi ranks. The song that is the marching hymn of Nazism, Horst Wessel. The Horst Wessel lead, whose words every German knows. Make way! Make way! Here comes the Brown Battalion. Make way! Make way! The Stormtroop men are here. Upon the swastika, the millions look with longing. The day of freedom and of bread is near. Brown Battalion, a German army 150,000 strong sent to Nazify Austria. They stop newspaper presses, drive out Austrian editors and pressmen alike, rewrite the news to the Nazi mold. They expel from the country foreign correspondents who would report news of Vienna to the world. They invade Vienna's great Jewish department stores, confiscate the entire stock. They reorganize schools, text, teachers to fit Nazi rules. In a Vienna classroom...
In October 1934, the Bolshevistic Jews committed their most horrible outrage when they murdered Austria's brave Chancellor, Engelbert Dollfuss.
Miss Stengel, it was the Nazis themselves that killed Chancellor.
Children, this is the book we are going to use from now on.
and you must learn what it says.
But, Miss Stangl, Isidore is a Jew, and his father was on the other side. Wasn't he, Isidore?
Yes, he was, Miss Stangl. So the book's wrong, isn't it?
No, Isidore. The book must be right. We must learn what it says.
But are all the other things you taught us before wrong?
Yes, they're wrong.
No.
Whatever is in this new book is right. Go on, Hans.
The Jews are the enemy of all true Germans, for they have torn down the fine civilization built up by German culture. A Jew may be identified by his shifty black eyes, his big nose, hands like claws. But, Miss Stengel, Isidore isn't like that at all.
Just go on reading, Hans.
And the Jews...
What is it, Isidore?
Please, Miss Stengel, may I be excused?
Yes, Isidore, you may leave. Continue reading, Hans.
The Brown Battalions, 150,000 strong, Nazifying Austria. They convert devout ex-Chancellor Kurt von Schuschnigg's party offices into Nazi headquarters. Rip his crucifix from the wall. They label every Jewish shop and cafe in Vienna. They bar Jews from faculty and student body at the University of Vienna. At number 19 Bergasse, in the modest apartment of Vienna's greatest Jew, founder of psychoanalysis, Dr. Sigmund Freud.
No one going to answer the door?
Sigmund, you know who it is?
Of course, we've been expecting them, haven't we?
But Father, you...
Stay where you are.
Dr. Freud?
I am Sigmund Freud.
Captain von Salzmann, 5th Munich Infantry. We have orders to search this place. Come, Lieutenant.
But my father has been...
Go ahead. Search.
Take the back rooms. I will stay here. This is your desk, Doctor?
Yes. If you're looking for our passports, they're right on top, right on front of you.
Sigmund, all your papers, all your...
Quiet, Mark.
Open this safe, Doctor.
It's open.
This is all the money you have got in the house?
That's all.
Lieutenant.
Yes, sir?
Tear down the beds. Take the mattresses apart. Look for money. Now, Dr. Freud, if you'll escort me to your laboratory.
The doctor is ill.
I'm all right, Martha. But first, officer, will you tell me why you are taking all my money as well as our passports?
I will read you the charge. By order of the Third Reich, all property, visas, and money belonging to the Jew Sigmund Freud, who corrupted the pure German mind by his invention of the scientific fakery called psychoanalysis, must be immediately confiscated. The man put under protective custody.
Brown battalions, Nazifying Austria. They drive all Jewish doctors from Vienna's hospitals, overnight humbling the greatest medical center in the world. They turn Vienna's Northwest Railway Station into a concentration camp. They install Nazi commissars over the Austrian Burgtheater, the Vienna Opera House, famed for two centuries throughout Europe. And in the rehearsal hall of the Vienna Philharmonic, oldest and most famed orchestra in Europe, as the morning rehearsal is about to begin, to the podium strides acting conductor, Dr. Scherkel.
Gentlemen, there will be no rehearsal today. I have just learned that Herr Bruno Walder has been removed from his post as our conductor. Nor will I ever conduct you again. And for reasons which we all know, many of you will not be allowed ever to play in the Philharmonic again. You all... That is all. Goodbye, gentlemen.
Dr. Scherkel.
Yes, Herr Rose?
As concertmeister, I think I can speak for all of us.
Yes?
Tomorrow or next week or sometime, when the new conductor is appointed, some of us will be coming back. But I don't know how to say it. There is a Viennese way of making music. It is the comradeship that we have all felt with each other, with you, Herr Walter, all of us, that has made our music come from the heart. And now, some of us will be coming back. We will play maybe the same works, same notes we have so often played together. But Schubert, without the love of a Viennese, a Philharmonic without Schubert, without Bruno Walter, without you, Dr. Schirken. No.
Thank you, Herr Ross.
Dr. Schirken, will you lead us in one piece, Schubert?
Yes. What will it be?
Rosamunde. The B-flat entr'acte. We do not need the parts.
The entr'acte. Yes.
Listen to the March of Time, brought to you by Life, the news magazine of pictures. Americans have died fighting at the river of Jarama, in the streets of ruined Teruel, on the plains of Lunete, and the mountains that still stand between Franco and the sea. 250 Americans have given their lives to stop the march of fascism in bloody Spain. And while more than 3,000 Americans are still in Europe fighting, many others are returning home wounded. In the issue of Life, the news magazine of pictures out tomorrow, you will meet 15 of these young men who have come back. And Life gives you the biography of each of them. Their pasts are as different as their characters. One a World War ace, one a clerk in a textile factory. Yet they're all Americans with an idea they were willing to die for. Says 22-year-old Jerry Warren,
I guess I'm the smallest American who's fought in Spain. I quit Brooklyn College after 1 year to be a clerk in a coat factory. I consider Spain the battleground of democracy.
Says Frederick I. Lord.
I shot down 22 planes during the World War. Came out with the rank of major in the U.S. Air Corps. Then I turned professional soldier and went to Mexico and from there to Spain. The struggle of the Spanish people changed me from an adventurer to a zealous partisan.
2 million families will see these and 13 other young Americans invalided home from Europe in the issue of Life out tomorrow. 2 million families, 18 million people in all, will look forward to Life's coming to follow with their own eyes the news of the world and the ways of the world's people. And as well as the spectacle of broken cities and broken lives in war-torn Europe, these men and women will see other things on the world's news front they have never seen before. They will watch extraordinary experiments with lightning at General Electric's laboratories in Schenectady. They will see how unmarried mothers are cared for at St. Faith's home in Tarrytown, New York. They will go to a party for the sweetheart of Sigma Chi. Be sure your family does not miss this big issue of Life. Get a copy at your newsstand tomorrow morning, early. Time marches on.
Again next Thursday night at this same time, the March of Time. This is the National Broadcasting Company.